Well, good morning. It sounds like sounds like you're all ready. I'm not sure. Let's see if we can control the feedback, take out some of our electronics here. Not sure if that's going to do it or not. Sounds better. Good morning. Maybe a little better. Move this down. See how that works. Again, good morning. I'm Rick Barton, the co-director with Karen von Hippel, who I think is here in the room, of the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project. And on behalf of John Hamry, our president here at CSIS, it's really a great pleasure to have all of you here today. I know that many of you have been involved with this issue of PRTs over the last couple of years. And in fact, I'd be a little bit curious how many people have actually served on a PRT or been out in the field with one. So we've got a good initial, and how many people have worked on the design and the development of the PRTs here or the leadership of them here in Washington. So it's really a good representation, I think, of some people that have been involved. We were hoping to make this maybe the first alumni reunion. But I guess there's still a little bit of work to be done in terms of building the cadre. But thank you all for coming, and thanks for your service out there in the field. Those have been really incredibly challenging situations. And, of course, we visited a number of these places ourselves over the last few years and helped to prototype some of this kind of same sort of idea going back to Haiti in the mid-1990s. So it's really one of these critical experiments that needs to be developed if we're going to become more effective as a country in these conflict zones. And what's great about our guest today, Congressman Vic Snyder, is that he, too, is tremendously committed to the idea of improving the way we operate in the field, to our effectiveness, to our interagency approach. He's dedicated a great deal of time and the talent of his staff, and we thank them for their work as well. To addressing the shortcomings of the U.S. government, but also just improving those things that we do well. And I think the PRTs probably fall into both categories. So it's a great pleasure to have Congressman Snyder here today. I think what he's going to do is speak for 10 or 15 minutes. Then we'll have a bit of a conversation and include all of you in the questions. And again, as usual, we'd ask you to please identify yourselves. This is being recorded. It should be up on the website within 24 hours, and it looks as if we'll have a video as well as the audio. So we need to know who it is that's asking the questions for the audience that's not here with us right now. So great to have you all. Congressman, thanks for your work, and great to have you here today.
Thank you, Rick. It's good to be with you. Is this like WCSIS television? Live from downtown Washington. It is good to be with you this morning. I think I'll sit here until somebody says they can't hear me very well. You know, I walked in and they gave me this microphone, and I have to share this one story, you know, and then they turned it on. My wife is a minister back home, and she taught me early on the most important, I know there's some young people here and some interns here today, the most important thing you may want to learn from this today is when you have one of these microphones, be sure it's off when you go in the bathroom. There was a minister back home, true story. I know somebody who was at the congregation. He decided just before he'd go out for the beginning of the service to go in the bathroom, and unfortunately he had his microphone on. The congregation was full, big full house, and so they sat there for about 5 minutes listening to this, you know, wonderful sounds from his bathroom. When he came out, they gave him a standing ovation, and that was the beginning of the service. So I wanted to spend a few minutes and talk about our report and then just really hear your either comments or questions or thoughts, and if there's things that I don't know much about, and there probably will be. We've got some of the staff members here, both in the committee staff, my personal staff, that worked on this report. I want to say just a word about, we called this thing, what do we call a report, Agency Stovepipes versus Strategic Agility. And I wanted to just comment about the word strategic agility, because I think we kind of struggle a little bit with what exactly. What do we think our foreign policy apparatus ought to look like as we're looking ahead? And you hear some people use the term smart power. I don't have any problems with that. It implies that we ought to not just be about our military. We ought to be about our diplomacy, about our economic power, about our moral force in the world. What I like about the phrase strategic agility is it implies that there may be things we need to do tomorrow that we can't do right today, but we're agile enough, we can pull things together and move and adapt to changing situations. And I think what we have learned, unfortunately, the hard way, perhaps, in the last several years in both Iraq and Afghanistan, is that we're not as agile as we perhaps had hoped we were, perhaps not as agile as we thought maybe we had learned to be in Bosnia, that we still have some work to do. This report came from our House Armed Services Committee, Subcommittee on Oversight and Investigations. Let me say a word about that, a few political junkies. When the Republicans took over in 1993, they eliminated the Subcommittee on Oversight and Investigations. I wasn't here then. I think it was part of their kind of cutting back on the size of government, looking for ways where they could save money in the legislative branch. I think they thought that oversight could be done by, you know, the Military Personnel Committee and the Readiness Subcommittee. And well, it didn't work. And in the view of a lot of us, oversight has been really abysmal over the Pentagon or military. Any oversight done by the Armed Services Committee has just not been very effective or sustained as it ought to be. And so when the Democrats took back control a year and a half ago, one of the things that we did was reinstitute the Oversight Investigation Subcommittee. And Ike Skelton used to serve on that committee, now our full committee chair, and so he was a strong believer in it. You may recall that Marty Meehan was the first subcommittee chair. The committee worked with Lori Finner, the staff director for the Subcommittee on Oversight Investigations. For the first 6 months, we worked on a report on the training of Iraqi troops. That report was finished, and then Marty resigned and went to a college in Massachusetts, and Ike asked me to take over the chairmanship. And what we did originally is we did a series over a month in July a year ago, a series of hearings on what next in Iraq. And we brought in retired generals and think tankers, and just, we call it our third way series. Taking the situation we're at in Iraq today, where do you think we should go? And the committee members, both Republican and Democrat, really liked the discussions that we had. I think it informed a lot of people about ways to think differently about and looking ahead towards Iraq. But then the question became, well, where do we go from there? And it seemed to me that it was important, that, number one, that we stay hooked in with what's going in Iraq. And that was part of why we did the PRTs. But second, this issue has been floating out there for some time, a lot of work going on in think tanks, a lot of discussions going on in the Pentagon, the State Department, about the whole issue of the relationships between the different agencies of our government, and a lot of dissatisfaction with what's going on. And so we decided to undertake a look at the provincial reconstruction teams, partly just in our oversight function of how are they doing, what kind of help do they need from us, what kind of obstacles are there in government, either statutory or by policy. But also with the idea that perhaps as we look at these, it will also be a keyhole that will let us get a view of, well, what is going on with the different agencies of government, how they relate, how are they doing on this specific project. And I think our overall conclusion is that, number one, it was worthwhile looking at the PRTs as an end itself, and number two, it really did help us get a feel for some of the challenges that we have with regard to the workings of of our different agencies of government. Right off the bat, one of the things that we figured out was we used the term PRTs, and we had a couple of former PRT members who we had some private meetings with them that said, you ought to not even call them PRTs, because the work that they do, the PRTs do in Afghanistan, is so dramatically different from the work they do in Iraq. Why do we call them the same thing? Because it gives the impression the American people and the government and the Congress that they're all doing the same thing. And my simplistic understanding of that is that in Afghanistan, when these things started, they were much more project-oriented. Let's see what we can do to build a school. Let's see what we can do to build a water system. In Iraq, as things evolved, they were much more focused on capacity building in governments. Let's see what we can do to help the local officials figure out how to get everything together they need to build a school. Let's see how we can help the local health departments get together to do immunization programs. So that was one of the differences. One of the other things that we early on figured out is just some remarkable, I'm not really saying this in the spirit of you over here who are part of these PRTs, this is not suck-up language, but really are remarkable people who stepped forward and worked on these PRTs, and that continues to be the situation today. And I guess a couple thoughts about that. One is they are such remarkable people that they had a lot of success. The other side of that is I think they would have had a lot more success if we on the rest of the government had done our part in supporting them with structures and chains of commands and clarity of goals and ways of lessons learned and all those kinds of things. But there are really some remarkable people that serve on these things. And for a lot of them, I think it was just a wonderful time in their career, a life-changing kind of experience. A group of us had dinner with Michael Hanlon a couple of weeks ago. And Hanlon has been one of those, I guess I won't characterize his position on the Iraq War, but one of the things that he said in 2001, early 2002, while we were having this debate going on in this country about the possibility of a war with Iraq to remove Saddam Hussein, is that one of the positives he thought with regard to our going into Iraq was, I think his words were something like, we were reasonably good at development of other countries. And I asked him about that quote the other night, and he said, well, I wasn't right on everything. And I think what happened was that people looked at what had happened in Bosnia and thought, yeah, we're reasonably good at development. But now we look at what has occurred in Afghanistan and Iraq, and we're not saying that we're reasonably good at that anymore, that it really is a challenge, and we do have a lot to learn. One of my constituents has served both in Afghanistan and Iraq. She has, I think maybe is still a Department of Agriculture employee, and is a veterinarian, and has been working, has worked in both these countries, really loves it, her family's come over to my house several times, and she's got kids, but she just really is hooked on the importance of doing this for her country to help these people in these other countries. And we had some email, my staff has been emailing with her back and forth, and we quote her in this report, but I'll read to you her report in which she says, if I don't have my glasses on, she said that it struck her that she says, the cultural barriers between the military, Department of State, and other civilian agencies seem more striking than those between the United States and the Iraqis to me. We say the right things about breaking out of stovepipes, but our comfort level tends to put us right back in the mindset, the language, and our ways of doing business within our own agency. Now, that was somebody who was over there at the time who was saying, I think the differences between our agencies are greater than our relationships with the Iraqis. Now, that has got to be of concern to us all. And she didn't get fired, by the way, after we published that quote in the report. We, in the course of talking with former PRT members, one of the things that comes out is they work real hard, remarkable people. A lot of them felt like they had success, but also they all shared certain frustrations. And from those frustrations, is where we start tracing, okay, what leads to some of those frustrations? That kind of work is always going to be hard. It's always going to have frustrations. But are there things that we should have been doing differently as a government to eliminate some of those? I'll just go quickly through some of these things, of which the report discusses in a lot of detail. One of them is it was a lot of improvisation. They didn't really get a lot of strategic guidance. They didn't get a lot of oversight, particularly early on. One person described it as it was like a pickup game. They could kind of reinvent themselves and had to reinvent themselves in the areas that they were assigned. But we as a government didn't do a very good job of helping them see where they fit into the whole broad picture of what we were trying to do in Iraq and Afghanistan. Chain of command. This is the report. It's online. We have some copies here if you haven't seen it. This is very artful cover, right? Kind of your typical cover. Nice pictures of good people trying to do good things for communities. But on page 21, this is what I wanted the cover to be, was this chart that was provided by the Department of Defense. And I wanted this to be on the cover with the title, if you understand this, you don't need to read it. And because they came up with this chart to try to explain the chain of command and how all these agencies relate, and nobody can understand. You look at that and think, what the hell is this? And but part of the problem is, what is the chain of command? And that starts right here in Washington, and those things were not very clear. The second thing is, when you have areas of really good people trying really hard to do good things for their country and for the country where they're living, good things happen. But a lot of that becomes personality dependent. if you have good people that can work together, good things can happen. And probably the best example of that right now is we see, you know, the Petraeus Crocker team is kind of in great harness together, and we all have some apprehension, okay, when they go elsewhere, well, how will the next team in harness do? And we're optimistic we'll have good players there. But we shouldn't have a system which becomes dependent so much on the personalities. Another part of that is the funding streams, and similar kind of thing. Another chart that was prepared for the briefing, this one on page 23 of your hymnal, and I don't understand this one either, but the nice thing about it was this, the briefers, when they presented this to the staff briefing, acknowledged that it really took them quite a while to put this kind of chart together. Now, it looks to me kind of like a donut with some other donuts around it that it wouldn't be that hard. But I appreciate them for working hard on it. But the fact that they had to work so hard to come up with something that is hard to understand gives you a sense of the complexity of funding streams right now. And if you're a PRT person, you don't want complexity in your funding stream. You want to understand it very rapidly, what kind of funds you have available and how you can use them. Another issue, it goes back to the sense of, what's the nature of a pickup game? The nature of a pickup game is you may, out there on the court, want a 6'6" center, but what you have is another 5'10" guard, and that's what you have to use for that game that day. That's the nature of a pickup game. And, you know, there was very public discussions between Secretary Rice and Secretary Gates about staffing of these things in Iraq. And we still have those challenges. Secretary Gates, and I brag on him every chance I can, he is the most zealous advocate right now for USAID in the Department of State, probably starting with his Kansas State speech that some of us have quoted a bunch of times, in which he says we need dramatic increase in funding for the Department of State, we need dramatic increase in funding for USAID, we need a dramatic increase in personnel numbers for the Department of State, we need dramatic increase in personnel numbers for USAID, and it's all part of this smart power, strategic agility. If you don't have the players out there, how can you be agile when you're trying to put something together that's more than just a pickup game? Well, that's part of the problem. That was part of the challenge of the Secretary of State trying to, and the other agencies. They don't have the kind of redundancy that the military builds in for training and those kinds of things. Another challenge that we think is that there hasn't been a very good job of gleaning the lessons learned from these remarkable people that are working in difficult situations and having some successes despite some of the intricacies of the government behind them, but there hasn't been a very formal way of learning those lessons. And in fact, that may be an institutional problem we have as a government, because we heard some people, I think formally in our hearings, and the staff heard informally, that there are people who say, well, you could have learned from the CORDS program in Vietnam and avoided some of these mistakes. But you should have gone back further than just, well, what happened in Bosnia? What happened in Somalia? What happened in Haiti? I mean, you could have learned goods and bads, and at a minimum, we need to be learning now from what has occurred this month and last year in Iraq and Afghanistan and turned it into something positive. And then the whole issue, too, of how do you judge, as part of the lessons learned, how do you judge success? And that's tricky in this kind of a situation. We had one person who felt that, and meant this positively, and I understand the sentiment, having worked overseas myself, that when they first went in, they sensed a lot of reluctance on the part of the local population, but as months went by, that people would wave when they went by. Well, okay, that is positive, and I understand that. That's pretty hard to hang, millions of dollars of taxpayers, millions of taxpayer dollars on, say, the waving quotient went up over 6 months. I think we need to have something more than that, particularly when what you're trying to do is not just build projects. You know, we built three water systems, and they're now supplying this much water, but when you're trying to increase the capacity of people to govern themselves, how do you measure that? And that's one of the challenges. So those are some of the kinds of things in broad outline that are discussed in the report, and the report sees, it goes in a lot of details about those. Part of all that led to, I think, some really healthy discussions in the Congress with the help of think tankers and retirees and current government workers on broader issues of our foreign policy. And so some of the things that came out of that is, in the defense bill that has passed the House, and the Senate has not yet quite done their version, We have included some things in that bill that deal specifically with these PRTs. One of the things we did was include Sam Farr's bill, which came through the Foreign Affairs Committee, passed the House, but has a hold on it by one of the senators who didn't like the bill. We took it, worked with Chairman Berman of the House Committee on Foreign Affairs, took that exact language and put it in the defense bill and said, okay, put a hold on the defense bill. I mean, that's essentially what we're doing. Let's find another vehicle, Sam Farr's bill that deals with the Civilian Reserve Corps, so the State Department would have a better ability to find the kind of personnel that they want and need. We sent an email and provided this to Ambassador Crocker, and I suggested, you know, we'd love to see you sometime when you're in D.C., and it wasn't very long at all before he said, I'm going to be there. Can I meet with your committee? And we sat down with him, was that last week or a week before, I think, and had a very positive discussion with him. And I think a lot of these things, very experienced guys, are already working on these things, but I think some of the things the report talked about with a different set of eyes, I think, has been helpful to them. And we've gotten some feedback from the embassy in Baghdad that they're working on some of these things, too. One of the lingering issues is we're not clear what the exit strategy is for all this. How do you go from a PRT to an area that's safe enough that the normal NGO community can be working there, or the other agencies of government that can work there? It's not clear, or the other international NGOs, it's not clear yet how that is all going to work, and maybe it's not going to be clear until it occurs. I think that's all I'm going to say, Rick, about that report. I want to touch on this other one. As part of what occurred as we were talking to representatives of the PRTs and agency heads, is it became clear that there was a lot of, I don't want to say confusion or lack of clarity on the whole benefits packages for civilians who serve in war zones. Now, we as members of Congress, we spend a lot of time worrying about how we treat our veterans, how we deal with PTSD, how we support families. We don't spend very much time at all worrying about civilians who are assigned or volunteered to go to a war zone from all the agencies. And I don't think the agencies have thought through that a lot either, because the reality is the numbers of you know, people from USDA are relatively small compared to the number of their employees. But it is a real issue of concern. I'll give you a couple of examples. And the poor workers' comp, federal workers' comp people are probably tired of me talking about this, but we had them testifying one day. There were, I think, workers' comp and USDA and somebody from the State Department. And so I presented a scenario. I said, let's suppose I'm a civilian and I'm in Iraq. And I work all the time, but I've got this 1 hour, I've got a basketball sitting there, I've got my music playing, I'm writing letters, so I present a situation, it was clear it was not work-related. And I'm sitting there, and a mortar comes in, and I'm wounded. Am I covered by workers' comp? And the answer was, well, it would depend on all the facts. We have to take each situation individually. I said, you're kidding, right? And the woman who was sitting next to him, or down the table, was very concerned because she worked for the State Department and was going to Iraq in like 2 days. I said, what are you saying? You can't, you know, well, it took 6 weeks to get a written response that, well, yes, they would be covered. But that kind of, what most of us would think is the most basic situation and the most basic assurance that you would give to somebody as a civilian going there, there's others even, this is another example. After the report came out, we heard from one of the military organizations. They had a situation where they had Lori may help me with this, but they were doing, I think, either a criminal investigation or an investigation of a contract or something, and they happened to have a civilian and a military uniform person that were a team, and they were traveling around, I think it was Iraq, doing investigatory work, and they were sitting next to each other when they were both killed. And the family was real upset because the honors, how the burial was done, it was different for the civilian, even though they were doing exactly the same work and subjected to all the same risks. And we as a nation need to be sensitive. If we're going to expect more and more of these wonderful people, some of whom are with us here today, who serve in a civilian capacity, we've got to recognize their sacrifices too, and that includes PTSD and dealing with family support, all those kinds of things, and we probably haven't done as good a job on that. So this report came out separately about that, which I think has helped, if nothing else, cause the agencies, the other agencies of government to say, this is something that we need to look at, and we have seen some improvement in that. The final thing I think I want to just say is, one of the things that we're going to do as a committee, starting probably July, heading before we recess for the year, is, and we're starting this, you know, we're just a little subcommittee with fairly small staff, but we're going to try to look at this whole issue of, what's the grand strategy for the United States? Where does all this fit into a big look at what foreign policy of the United States, what we ought to be looking at as we go ahead 5 and 10 and 15 and 20 years down the line? And Mr. Skelton likes the ideas to do so much, he's stealing one of our ideas. And so we're hoping to have the first part of this will be at the full committee level. I think it'll be great. And we're going to see if we can get some, higher former Secretary of State or one or two, to talk about this. Let's step back. We've been focused so much on Iraq, Afghanistan, Al-Qaeda, and other terrorist groups. Let's step back. What should be the things that we're thinking about, And then we're going to follow that up with some think tank peoples and retired generals. And I mention that because all this talk about PRTs and how they do and our ability to develop and strategic agility and all these kinds of things are tools that should help us achieve what our strategy is, our foreign policy strategy is for this country. And it may be that we're overdue as a nation to sit back and have some discussions about what we think about the Pacific, what we think about Europe, what we think about changing technology. And so we're hoping to be part of that discussion. Rick, I've probably gone longer than 10 minutes, but we'll just respond to any questions or criticism. I'll accept the compliments. The staff will accept the criticisms.
Well, great. Thanks very much. I think maybe the place to start is where you finished. And if you're going to be looking at the grand strategy, obviously one of the significant issues will be, what do we do in these kinds of places, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, possibly Nigeria, whatever the future is going to bring to us. And you also mentioned Secretary Gates' speech and the rather broad recognition that we don't have the civilian capacity that we need. I think the average American taxpayer is looking for trade-offs, is wondering, okay, so does that mean that Secretary Gates and Secretary Rice are going to go together to the Hill, where a lot of people say the problem is, and ask the appropriators to make some trade-offs, to take some weapon systems and put it into addressing these kinds of problems, or looking at another way of not just plussing up or not just finding a supplemental? Do you see any desire among your colleagues or as you look at a grander strategy to take on the problem in that way, or is it how will it be done?
I think several things. First of all, I think there's a part of what I applaud Secretary Gates for is he made these comments with full knowledge that he has a lot of financial needs in the military right now in terms of we're increasing the size of the military, which is going to bring legacy costs for a long time. The cost of buying all the replacement vehicles, all those kinds of things from the war. So at the same time, he knows he has financial needs and that it is increasing. He is saying, but wait a minute, if you want to be strategically agile, you've got to do a better job on the civilian side. And I think there's broad support for that in the Congress. One of the issues is funding. And I think, we don't go into that kind of detail. But Mr. Spratt and I had those kinds of discussions that we had in the budget year, and we did plus up some of the State Department activities. But that's going to be an ongoing discussion, Rick. But I don't think we should. My idea right now is we should not say, here is the pool of money for our national security. That's it forever. Now you all fight it out down here. I'm not sure that's going to be how you're going to get what, in Secretary Gates' words, dramatic increases in the number of State Department employees and USAID employees and the money that they have to work with. I think we whacked at that. It was an easy hit for Congress for years, and we have paid the price for it.
In terms of the clarity of goals or the improvisation that you talked about, how do you think, what do you see as a way to produce more clear goals and for these PRTs and in these kinds of places?
I think, I mean, the report is pretty detailed about some of all these things. The part of it is lessons learned. Part of it is there needs to be a, you know, this is what these folks are trying to do is help countries build at the same time there's a shooting war going on. And so that makes it much more complicated. So it becomes important for our government, for the Ambassador Crockers and the General Petraeus to say, okay, if we're going to have them subject to that risk, even though we're in a shooting war, we've got to step back and say, where do they fit into this? Where do they fit into our strategic plan for this country? It's got to be more than just saying, we promised that governor we'd do some work there, let's send a PRT there. I'm not saying that occurred, but it needs to have a sense of what we hope to accomplish, what we think they can accomplish, and how that fits into the bigger scheme of things. And that starts here in Washington, too.
Let me ask one more question, and then we'll move to the audience. Do you feel that the leadership cadre is deep enough, is skilled enough? We talk about building a civilian reserve corps, but we could easily put hundreds of civilians underneath rather unprepared leadership. Do you see that being developed at the same time, or how is that being developed?
You mean like PRT leadership?
Yeah, field leadership, PRT leadership, yeah.
I think that's all part of it, Rick. I think there's remarkable people. I think there really is remarkable people out there. I think we have remarkable people in this country. What I don't think we did such a good job is of pulling all those people together to get the best fit for the PRT, for the PRTs always. And part of that is the leadership level. Part of that is, you know, one of the basic issues is, well, who should be the controlling person? Should it be the civilian person? Should it be the military person that varied between Iraq and Afghanistan? But I think it's just all part of the picture. You have to get the right set of skills, and part of those skills are leadership skills. Some of them are veterinarian skills. Some of them are language skills. Some of them are sewer system skills. But that's just all part of having the group of people with the skills you want and knowing who those people are.
Let me move to your questions. And again, if you've... why don't we start right here? We'll go here, the second question. Rick, please introduce yourself.
Thanks, Rick. I'm Rick Olson. I'm the senior advisor to Stuart Bowen, the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction. And this is not suck-up language either, but your committee, Congressman, has done superb work in the PRT arena. And the report that you mentioned several times, a first-class piece of work, so thanks for that.
Thanks. I'd acknowledge Lori Fenner.
She did
the
great
staff
work.
Here. Did a great job.
A lot of the issues raised in the report and that you raised in the presentation here really flow from one essential question, and that's who's in charge. And I was the CJTF commander in Afghanistan and the director of the National Coordination Team in Iraq. It was fairly clear in the theater who was in charge. You know, we can argue about what kind of job we did, but the chain of command was not in doubt. The issue, though, and this is kind of following Rick's question about goals and about leaders, the real question is who's responsible for establishing goals, establishing doctrine for PRTs, developing leaders who can be on the bench and go into the theater when the time comes. So it's kind of what the military guys call proponency. Who has proponency for PRTs? Back here in Washington, will it be the Department of Defense or will it be the Department of State? And I was just wondering, Congressman, if the committee has developed any thoughts or if there's any sense in the committee about whether or not it ought to be a DOD responsibility or a Department of State responsibility to develop doctrine, to develop leaders, to train, and that type of thing.
Lord, sorry. I can't remember. I don't know if we specifically said that an agency.
Yeah, no, we didn't.
I don't think we did.
We didn't go as far.
You need her to need Lord to have a microphone.
Sure, that's a good idea. Yeah, we'll miss your valuable words otherwise.
Thank you, Lori Fenner from the ONI staff. Yeah. We didn't go as far as to make that kind of recommendation, but something that Mr. Berman and Mr. Skelton did do in legislation was to establish on the House side. Of course, this has to still go through conference. To establish an advisory council, kind of like the Defense Science Board, that will advise both the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of State on the kinds of stability and reconstruction and other kinds of things that require interagency operations. So be watching for that to go through conference, and if you want to call your senators, you could support that. So because they would advise Congress and state and defense.
One of the issues, that's our way, and Mr. Skelton and Mr. Berman's way, and they're working very closely together. We're all, you know, we've had people before that sit in our committee. That's our way, given the jurisdictions that we have, of dealing with this issue of the interagency stuff. We didn't include agriculture and justice, and you know, but we got state and DOD as a start on that. As you go further on up, we have had discussions about, well, when you talk about who coordinates the whole interagency, well, should that be in the National Security Agency? Where should that be? And it's not, I think that's part of this ongoing discussion that we're having, and you all are going to be participating in, is where should this interagency reform, what should the endpoint be? And I don't know what the endpoint should be, but I think it will impact on the question that you asked. And right now, it means there's a little bit of floundering around to try to sort it out until it's clear, and it's not clear right now. Maybe something will come from this. One of the things we did, and it didn't get the kind of press attention I thought it might have deserved, but about 2 months ago, we suggested, Mr. Skelton, that we have Secretary Gates and Secretary Rice testify jointly before the Armed Services Committee, and they did. And because what we focused on was this issue of how the agencies work together. Well, the press reported, I think, what was going to be funded through the supplementals. I mean, it kind of got really down the weeds. But the bigger issue, what they were excited about talking about, was what you just asked. How are we going to resolve these questions about who, when you have a blend of personnel and functions, about who controls? Secretary Gates says State Department needs to control a lot of this development stuff. He was very clear about that. It's not clear to how this is all going to play out as this goes on down the line. You know, you give the longer answers when you don't know how it's going to come out. You know.
Mark.
Mark Schneider, Senior Vice President, International Crisis Group. Congressman, I think that everybody is going to laud the work that the subcommittee has done on this issue. And
we're just proud that you actually read the report. So.
A couple of things. One is, it seems to me, when you talk about doctrine, there's a focus on the sort of the U.S.-led PRTs, 12, and obviously you've got another 14 that are led by others, each one of them somewhat different.
Yeah.
And I'm curious as to whether or not there's been any further discussion about how you get a unified doctrine in terms of the international PRTs. And second, as you talk about how do you get the transition, how do you make the transition into a situation where it is civilian-led because there's no longer the security issue that required the PRT in the first place in certain areas?
Yeah.
And what are those sort of benchmarks for moving towards civilian-led and really an Afghan government, hopefully-led, development and reconstruction effort in areas where you no longer have serious security problems?
And we didn't get into a lot of the detail on your second question there, but here's the scenario which has occurred and which will you know, God willing, will occur more and more, which is as you transition to where we say U.S. forces don't need to be in this area. This is going to be an Iraqi security zone or an Afghan security zone. Well, then what does that do to your American-led development people who say, now let me get this right. I'm going to be going, you know, I'm not a soldier, I'm a civilian. I'm going to be going in only with Iraqi-led troops in this area that was a U.S. sector. And I'm not sure how folks are going to feel about that, how that's going to work right away. And then the next step then is the NGO. I don't have an answer to your question. I think it's one of the challenges of doing all this development work in the midst of a shooting war, and it's a shooting war that does not have lines. You can't say, hey, as long as you stay south of this trench, you're okay. That's not the way it is, and I don't have a good answer for it. Tell me, your first question again was?
Sort of the international side of it.
All right, yeah. We took advantage, what was the group, Lori, that did the evaluation of the
grad students and leadership operator?
Yeah, we stole some of their work, because we did not spend a lot of time with the international-led PRT. The Italians have a team. There are several countries that have have teams, but we do talk about it some in the report, and it's just part of the complexity. Their conclusion was, I think, that some of them are doing really good work, and there's things to be learned from what they're doing, but it's just part of the complexity, because not only do we have variances between what the U.S. PRTs are doing in Afghanistan versus the PRTs in Iraq versus the embedded PRTs in Iraq, but there obviously are differences between how each country puts them together, and that's one of the complexities. And again, I don't have a good answer other than it would probably be helpful if we have a more systematic way of evaluating all of them.
Let me get Rob back here. In the back.
Have we heard from any former PRT members yet?
I don't think so, but there. But we'll
don't hold back, friends.
I'll just stall for time while they come up with questions. Rob Jenkins with USAID's Office of Transition Initiatives. The PRTs were designed for Iraq and Afghanistan, and for obvious reasons, we have substantial levels of troops in both those countries. Do you feel that it's worth our time and effort to perfect the model and then export that to places where we might not have so many troops on the ground of our own? And or should we spend time getting it right and maybe then advocate for putting U.S. troops on the ground in places that we haven't necessarily thought about it?
I think that's the perfect question, because that's what you want to have, that kind of evaluation, when you talk about lessons learned. Lessons learned, to me, doesn't mean that, well, this worked really well for this, so we're going to apply that same model to the next situation. We mentioned the CORDS program in Vietnam. Nobody is saying we've got to do exactly like we did in Vietnam, but part of that is, okay, what did we learn, what worked, didn't work, and why did it work there? Well, maybe one of the reasons it worked there is because of specific things distinctive to a shooting war in Iraq, that you would have a different model if you were elsewhere. I think that's just part of the ongoing evaluation process, if I understood your question.
I think that where you have lower levels of conflict, for example, in Liberia or Haiti,
yeah.
We were able to set up some of these kinds of structures by just putting our civilians as close to the special forces as possible. So if they were down the street, we had an office a block away. You could do that in that kind of a case, but and in other cases, we're going to have to probably do it almost all with local people rather than really having the insertion. And I think that, Rob has a very interesting program in Pakistan that really calls on the Pakistani government and uses the local government, not the national government so much, and uses their assets in a very creative way. So there are a lot of good examples out there that I think are being developed.
All those kinds of situations, I'll give you an example that I was involved in. It's just one little, mini, mini little detail in all this, but I think it was in, I forget what year it was. It was toward the Civil War in Sierra Leone was about wound down. I worked as a doctor in Sierra Leone for 6 months, and so I've always tried to follow what's going on there. So I went there just as the UN troops were moving out. They'd moved in some areas, but they weren't everywhere else. And that was also, you may recall, at a time when I think it was about 200 British troops were training the new Sierra Leone army. And they asked the United States, would you please provide some troops so we can say this is a joint U.S.-British training force. And so we did. We provided three troops. One person of the Air Force, one Marine, and I forget who the other one was. So I'm a former Marine. So the Marine, I get there, and I meet this young guy. I got one current, one former Marine right here. So this is a young guy, tough guy, and he said, we went out and drank beer. He said, I got to talk to you. I said, what's going on? Here's the situation. This is a true story. The day he came into the country, they were helicoptering him, I think, from Guinea, because we didn't have any flights into Sierra Leone. He said, I was on the helicopter. He said, literally, I was with an American woman who was 65 years old, wearing a neck brace, who came to work for a relief group. We landed in Freetown. She got into a Jeep or something and drove off to Bo or someplace out in the rural area where she was going to work. I land, and the first thing the ambassador tells me is, you are prohibited by military regulation from leaving Freetown. You can't stay outside of Freetown overnight. And he said, she was wearing a neck brace. She was just so angry. Well, I got that resolved when I got back because I actually talked to the commandant about it. Well, come on now. That's just one little example. This is Ambassador Joe Melrose, who I met with yesterday, by the way. It drove him crazy. He said, the ambassador on the ground has got to be the one that makes that call. That can't be something set by the commandant of the Marine Corps that, no, a Marine can't leave Freetown. So those are the kind of things that we still have to struggle with.
Very, very common.
Yeah, one way in the back there, right?
Yeah, he's from a PRT, so that's good.
Uh-oh, he's hiding back there. He's getting near the door.
Hello, my name is Stan Byers. Served on the Bamiyan PRT in Afghanistan. One of the limitations that we had, I think actually one of the reasons why Office Transition Initiatives that Rob's with is so effective, is the flexibility in funding that OTI has that we didn't have on the ground. And we are often, the people that we are working with knew we had to spend the money, and it was a requirement to just push through and get stuff done rather than be able to be flexible on what a changing situation required. And I was wondering whether the Congress had looked at that, because there is a need clearly for oversight, and whether it might make sense to take a page out of the book of the military and instead of setting funding goals that you have to spend so much, set objectives that you need to reach funding and then be held accountable for how well you meet those objectives, but have the flexibility to spend the funding as necessary.
Yeah. My guess is if I advocated for that we need to judge agencies by their ability to spend a certain amount of money by a certain date, I would not win many elections. So I'm not in favor of that, that model. The only thing I can say is that the report discusses the funding issues in some detail, but doesn't come up with, I think, a good resolution for it. But the conclusion is that here you had PRTs, and at the time they might need a certain kind of money or a certain amount of money, it wasn't always available, and it seemed easier for the military to be able to get their funding rapidly for whatever the military was doing apart from the PRTs. And that's not a good answer to the question, but I agree that it ought to be judged on what's achieved. But it also needs to recognize that you're in a war zone. This is not the same thing as trying to get an appropriation bill through Congress. You need to have, you know, if you're trying to build capacity in an area and everybody's coming together and, you know, it's going great and you promise, well, we're going to put up 10% of the funding for this water project and the Iraqis are going to put up the rest. You actually need to be able to do it like that. You don't need to say, well, I'm sorry, we thought we were going to have it. It's gotten bogged down again. So you've got to have a fair amount of flexibility. You've got to have an understanding of where that's coming from. You've got to have a sense of what your budget is, what you can promise or not overpromise. And I think there's still a lot of work that needs to be done on that area.
We now have a lot of questions. can we group about three or four
My memory's not very good, Rick. I've got my pen out here.
but if we both write them down,
like a lightning round.
So why don't we just get your comments? If you can keep them really brief, I think we can get maybe five or so. Let's see how we do with them. Why don't we start right here, and then we'll move to the gentleman in the middle, Hamid, and well, right there. If you're right there and you got a question, you're sure, and we'll move it up.
Yeah, my name is Ashley Abbott. I was with the Afghanistan PRT program for about 2.5 years. I was in Kandahar, Helmand, and Zabul in the south with the special forces. So we do have people out there in the field, and that's how you do it. We put 7,000 kilometers on a land cruiser with small units moving around, mostly protected by Afghan troops as well as special forces ODAs, and that's how you get in the village. So answer number one. Number two is we moved away from the OTI funding mechanisms way too quickly in Afghanistan. We went from a situation where we're still facing unconventional warfare in the south and a serious insurgency. We decided that it was a normalized, regularized mission and failed to apply the right timing principles and activities to the environment. The enemy has a vote, the environment has a vote, and the war's not over just because we decided it was. And look at Argandab. So there are ways to do this. The funding mechanisms need to stay flexible. And yeah, it's a good idea to have strategic coherence because you need to be able to run the strategic programs and the foreign internal defense on the security side so that you have a coherent army and police 7 years down the line, and that you have to be able to the ministerial capacity building and the foreign internal defense mechanisms. But if you try to regularize, conventionalize, and strategize to the provincial and the district level, we will continue to fail because we're taking a big square box and putting big square conventional units in a place that has no, that we need to be adaptable, flexible to the environment and in the changing situation, not wait 275 days for funding approval or roll out only in labs where you can get to 5% of the roads in Kandahar province and let the insurgents take the other 95%. So thinking about the big picture is important, but the big picture is going to depend on operational and tactical effectiveness, which gets right down to the details. So as nice as it is and as easy as it is to write the PowerPoint five different times, if we're not executing on the ground, that's where we will fail, not up here, down there. So streamline the mechanisms to allow the flexibility on the ground. I don't know if we can do that anymore.
I think that when this, she'd be a wonderful person to have a lessons learned discussion with in a formal way. I mean,
Good. Last year, I've never seen one report. It never gets circulated. Yeah. It's a nice project for people, but do it once, do it right, circulate, disseminate. Stop sending people down. I'm trying to get work done.
Well, I understand that. I've got some bad news. I hope that we continue to send people down because the situation changes. I really appreciate your comments. I think you're real good, real healthy. I want to make the one comment about the issue versus top down versus what's on the ground, and that we have had that discussion in a variety of different ways, and it's like baby bear's porridge. It's got to be just right, which is you do not need to be out there on your own without a sense of where all this fits into the bigger picture. On the other hand, those folks who say, oh, hey, we've come up with this big picture, totally divorced from what the people are on the ground, let's send more dictates down to them, that would be a terrible thing to do. And how you do that blend is a challenge. And I actually think that challenge right there, as just what you discussed, is the key to, if we solve that problem, then we will have dealt with this whole issue of interagency reform. Because that's the ultimate people on the, I guess I'll say boots on the ground question is, all that interagency stuff at both the top and down on the ground has to work so that you feel like you're getting the support you need and the guidance you need without being pushed into boxes that you shouldn't be pushed in.
Yes, sir.
Well, we're not doing much of a lightning round right now. That was a great comment. I appreciate it.
Do you think that microphone's on? Can you hear it?
A little closer.
Just hold it close to your mouth and see if that works. Yep. No, it's not on yet. It doesn't seem like it's on.
I have seen many of the work of the PRTs in Afghanistan, particularly in maybe in most of the provinces. I think they have done a very fantastic job in some of the provinces. The capacity is different. You raised a couple of very good points. One was that how we judge the successes, because that is the most important, that how we can feel that when will be the time that the Afghan can take the lead. On that sense, I think the most important is that how we can expand the outreach in the security zone and then the capacity of the local governance that they can take the lead to lead the development aspect. And I think if we judge by that kind of a basis or criteria, I think we will be much more suitable then to have the number of projects implemented in a particular province.
Yeah, I agree with that. And Ambassador Crocker feels that way, too. And what do they call that, Laurie, the maturity model? I mean, I think it's for you all that do development work, but that's what they're looking at. It's for those of us, you know, who watch out for taxpayers' money, it's a lot easier to go back home and say, you know, we built 23 water projects last month in this area. It's a lot easier to talk about that when in reality the greater good may be to be able to say, well, the maturity model is looking better and better for governance, but that's, I agree with you. Yeah.
The second point is that the policy discussion at the strategic level, we are focusing on that, how we can streamline and synergize from the capitals down to the PRT on the ground level, their command and structure and operation. Yes, that is a problem. But at the same time, we are less engaged in the discussion about the local interlocutors with whom they should be engaged in the same kind of a principle and requirement and the benchmark to be discussed between the PRTs and the strategic level with the local and, for instance, with the Afghans or Iraqi, that how they should be prepared and by which time that they can take all these responsibility in the because that is also not clear. I haven't seen a single document within our own government that they guide the governors or the provincial departments that how they should work with the PRTs and how they could benefit effectively. So that needs a very clear engagement in both sides to make the work of PRT successful. Because currently what is happening is it depends on the personality. A good governor, a good PRT commander, they are coming together very effectively. For instance, looking to host, they change the whole face because there is a personality, there is a personality, and they are working together and they're making a difference. So that is another issue that might be useful to think about.
I think I forget who coined the phrase in all this, but the phrase is interlocutor fatigue, which is what we've been talking about, the frustrations of our personnel. If you're an Iraqi or a local Afghan leader, an Iraqi leader, and personnel change, and you've had a variety of agencies come through, and you've got the military folks, and then they change, and you're trying to get a damn school built, or just trying to pull your, and the personalities keep changing with varying language skills and different interpreters, I thought interlocutor fatigue was a pretty good phrase, because the receiving end of that has got some frustrations too.
I think we're going to have time for about two more questions, because I understand you may have votes. So we could have why don't we do this? Anybody from PRTs?
This one right here.
Were you in a PRT? Okay, great. Why don't we go with you? And then we'll come down over here.
Hi, Lieutenant Colonel Linda Granfield, former PRT commander in Jalalabad, Afghanistan. And it goes to Minister Stanikzai's point, is how do we institutionalize those individuals that get it and that come out of the PRTs and are very effective working with their governors and get the trade, because it's an art, it's not a science. And so for instance, myself and many of the former PRT commanders and aid reps come back and then they're lost and they're not in, you know, studying Afghanistan or doing anything with Afghanistan. And so I just think that at a point we've got to institutionalize those skills, and it goes to lessons learned and create some sort of system and mechanism in order to employ those folks, you know, back into the field. I think PRT commands and PRTs should be there for 2 to 5 years, the same person, because you develop those relationships. And I've been pushing this quite frequently within OSD. And I know General Olson will disagree with me, but I don't think the Air Force and the Navy, and sorry, folks, are the right fit for that. I mean, I'm an active duty civil affairs officer. I've been doing this for 15 years. PRT command is exactly what I've been training myself to do, you know, over those 15 years. And so I think we're missing some of the institutionalizing, you know, that art and the skill set that needs to go with that.
I think that's a good point. I think that's all part of the strategic agility. I think that maybe the only thing I'd add to your good comment is it's like anything else. It's finding the right people, but then also with the right level of training, the right level of support. But I'd add in one other thing, both in the civilian side and the military side, you've got to have the right incentives. And we've got to recognize that if you decide you stay there for a year or two or three, that it not only doesn't hurt your career, it enhances your career. That we recognize this is an important thing to do, and you're going to get your professional military education will relate to it. We just have to continue to build those skills. I guess it's similar to everything else the military does. You find good people that are appropriate for the slot and train them and learn from what they've done and have them lead junior people in learning those skills also.
I think the rotation policies are going to probably have to change, certainly across the government.
And the rotation policy is part of the whole challenge of doing this in a war zone. I mean, I saw Ambassador Crocker the last week, and you know, I think he's probably ready to be out of that war zone. I mean, you start talking about saying, okay, we need people willing to spend 2 to 5 years in some very challenging environments in a shooting war. That's a pretty tough thing to ask people to do.
Yeah. The gentleman right here in the middle.
Thank you.
Travis Garland, the last question, I think.
International Relief and Development. I don't want to repeat. We're the implementing partner, USAID implementing partner for community stabilization. I just flew in from Al Anbar last night. What you said, ma'am, was very well put. And the 7,000 miles on the SUV getting out there, and Congressman, your story about the lady with the getting in the Humvee or the right SUV off, and taking off. I'm sorry, I have to admit I didn't read the report. I just, like I said, got in late last night and was told about this a few hours ago. But
we will get you a copy.
Thank you. Working with the PRTs out in Al Anbar, I've been out there for 2.5 years, and the one thing I notice is they're very jealous of the fact that I move around and I interact with Iraqi peoples. In fact, I've lived in Ramadi since September of last year. I have over 600 Iraqi employees. that's who's around me. So I have this knowledge. When I need to go down and see the city council, no problem. When I need to interact with the DJ of water or sewage, he can come to my house, and we have chai, and we sit and we talk. The PRTs, I agree with you, Congressman, there are a lot of good people on them, very smart, with lots of stuff. They bring a lot of stuff to the table, but they can't get off the fob, or when they do, it begs the question, who's in charge? They're riding in Humvees, and they're wearing military uniforms. So when they get out, and they have very limited time. I mean, and I talk with them. They say, Travis, you know, we need to find out who's this person. Can you find out who's in charge of the library? Because I can only move on Tuesday. Has anyone of the PRTs, or do you in your report, talk about their frustration, their need to be able to move? And I think they're quite jealous of the fact that us NGOs are able to.
No, that was an issue. I mean, I think it was one of those basic things. I mean, people just described it as pretty basic. If we don't have the security side of this that has a sense of our importance, where they will put a priority on us going out, we will not get work done. If we're on the schedule to go to a certain area tomorrow, but we get, every time something flares up somewhere, we get bumped because they see the pure military side of it being more important, we're not going to get any work done. And that was a frustration level, a frustration that was expressed. There were also some other issues that came up with regard to the mix of civilian and military, and some people would have their civilian people be out of uniform, and that people got a little jumpy about that. Well, now wait, you're having people in a war zone not in military attire. What does that mean for the rules of war? I mean, there's some complexities on the issue of the nature of the blend of civilian and military. But the issue of transportation it's just part of security, but probably second only to security was the most people felt was the critical thing. If you couldn't get to the area you're supposed to work in, you did nothing.
Well, please join me in thanking Congressman Vic Snyder, and thank you all for coming.
Thank you very much.